Rita Golden is a household name for many people the world over who have read her books, her articles, her essays, and who appreciate her writing. Marita is known for her careful creation of her characters and her pointed and powerful sharing of her own life and her own experiences. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I am so glad you are here to join me today on this journey into the life of a truly gifted and talented individual. Marita Golden, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me again, Pamela. I'm so glad to be here.
Now, Marita, you are here today celebrating how many years of writing?
Well, I'm celebrating officially the 35th anniversary of the publication of my very first book, Migrations of the Heart. If I were to celebrate my writing life, it would probably be from the time I was probably about 7 or 8 years old, and we don't want to go back that far.
It's not even so, that far, so I won't press you.
I am celebrating the milestone of the publication of Migrations, because that really was kind of the official start of my career as an author of books. Even though I'd been writing journalism and poetry and stories before then. And I'm celebrating because when I sat down to write the book back in 1983, I had no idea that it would still be in print, that it would be a book that had touched so many people's lives. So I think whenever we can find an opportunity, an opening to celebrate ourselves, we need to do that.
Absolutely. Now, you were born in Washington, D.C., you studied in Washington, D.C., and somehow through the course of your lifetime, you've taught nationally as well as internationally. So walk us through how that came to be.
Do you mean the teaching, the writing, the everything?
Let's start with the everything.
Well, I was born here in Washington, and I grew up in a home where I think my parents consciously and unconsciously conspired to make me a writer, in that I had a mother who told me when I was about 12 years old, after having watched me read voraciously, write poetry, that one day I was going to write a book. And I had a father who was a great storyteller and who would tell me stories at bedtime about people like Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth, and who really, both of my parents instilled in me a strong sense of independence and from an early age a kind of critical thinking ability. You know, no topics were off limits, and they always talked to me like I was an adult. And so I really consider my parents to be kind of my first writing mentors, my first writing teachers.
You've said that you thought that you came into the world called to write. Tell us what the world was like as you were growing up. You were, as I said earlier, born in D.C., studied in D.C., and then, of course, moved beyond that. What was going on in the world? What was the tenor, if you will, of the world as you were a little one growing up?
Well, Migrations of the Heart specifically, for example, deals with my coming of age in the late 1960s, so that I graduated from high school 2 months after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And like for many of my generation, that was a pivotal event that was not just political, but that was deeply personal. And it really changed my attitude towards this country. And it changed my attitude about, you know, what I was going to do in the world. So the world that I had been born into was a world where, you know, legal segregation was law of the land, not just in the South, but in many parts of the North. People don't think of the North as being segregated formally and legally, but it was. And so by the time I was about to become almost a woman, the world was really being riven by enormous social change, and I found myself wanting to be a part of that.
You said that the death of Martin Luther King changed your attitudes, your goals, changed them from what to what?
Well, like many of my generation, we'd grown up with a very idealistic belief that many of our parents had of necessity, raised us on that, yes, we were treated as second-class citizens, all we had to do was work really hard, the doors would open, and there would be, you know, equality, and that integration was the goal. You know, we would integrate, and we would sort of be forgiven our blackness. But with the death of Martin Luther King, like many of my generation, I began to feel that there had to be a higher goal than just integration, that, you know, empowering black people culturally, politically, economically was more important than just integration. And so there was a shift from, you know, integration to black power. There was a shift in defining ourselves. You know, we were no longer ashamed. You know, when I was growing up, you call somebody black, my God, that was the worst insult. And the cultural change was so powerful that black became not an insult but an affirmation.
The focus of your writings would have changed, I would imagine. What did you begin to write about?
Well, when I was at American University, I had a column for the school newspaper, and I had a big afro, and I had a very militant stare on my face. You know, I just picture myself in it. I think it was a biweekly column. And I wrote about, you know, everything that was going on in the world at that time, from, you know, the Black Panthers to cultural changes to the need for there to be more black faculty and black studies classes on the campus, you know, of the school. And I began to find my voice as a poet. A lot of the poetry was angry, a lot of it was bad, but I was expressing myself. So, and it was a really exciting time, because that was a time when writers like Maya Angelou and Alice Walker and a little bit later, Toni Morrison were writing their first work. And it was really exciting to be young, gifted, and black, at a time when many black cultural icons who had been marginalized or disappeared were resurrected and put back in the center of the cultural space, and I could look at their work and find inspiration.
You said that you were attending American University, which is in Washington, D.C. How did this school take to your column?
Well, at that time, I mean, everybody was radical, you know. I don't mean literally everybody, but radical white students, radical black students, a radical challenge of the status quo, that really was the norm. So I was fitting in with the temper of the times. And in fact, this year, 2018 is, of course, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And I remember one of the things that I did for the school newspaper was I wrote a long essay for the school newspaper it was actually a photo essay. I went down to U Street and 14th Street, where the aftermath of the rebellions after King's assassination was starkly visible and inescapable. And I wrote a long essay about what it was like to be a young black person looking at the destruction. And there were photographs accompanying it. And it was a big two-page thing in the school newspaper. And just recently, the D.C. Historical Society produced a an issue acknowledging, you know, and sort of the 50th anniversary of all of that. And what they asked me to do was to, they wanted to, they're reprinting that article, and at the same time, they asked me to write an essay where I went down 14th Street today and looked at it. And it's so interesting because I titled the essay Erasure, because there's a profound sense of, yes, growth and change and prosperity, but at the same time, there's a profound sense that black presence, black culture has been erased. So they're putting the two together, the 50-year difference, which I think is kind of cool.
For those listening who are not familiar with the area that you're talking about, if you can, draw a mini picture of the area when you first wrote your article and the area today.
Well, 14th Street is a long corridor in Washington, D.C., and it intersects with the area that was the hub of African-American culture and business and social life. Due to segregation, it was the one section of the city where you had black businesses, black restaurants that black people would go to, so that this was, you know, and many urban areas have a 14th Street. You know, it's like our Harlem. So this was the area that was really, I mean, almost completely destroyed in the aftermath of King's assassination. Now today, as throughout the country, and not only the country, but the world, you know, gentrification of urban areas has fully taken hold in Washington, D.C. I mean, the entire city is being remade, so that this area that for many years, for about a decade or 12 years, had a very, 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 very slow rebuilding. About 12 years ago, the rebuilding ramped up, so that now it's an area of trendy restaurants, trendy bars, trendy clothing stores, and the racial makeup has changed a lot. The houses are much more expensive, and I think this is a scenario that many of your listeners are probably familiar with. So there's a huge difference between what I saw when I walked down the streets in 1969 and what I saw when I walked earlier this year.
And when we talk about the change in the housing and the expense of it, you're not talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars for a property. You're talking about millions of dollars for a property.
Yeah, in some cases, definitely, definitely so millions. And I think that even for African Americans who can remain, who choose to remain, who choose not to sell their properties to new people, the city gets about 1,000 new residents a year. I mean, 1,000 people every year, every month come to Washington, D.C. looking for housing. Okay. And even in long-term African-American neighborhoods where residents will choose to hold on to their property and not sell, one of the most disturbing developments is not just, you know, the fact that the houses are selling for so much more. Of course, that raises the value of their property, but also raises their property taxes. But there's a cultural imperialism that is very, very evident in that long-time African-American residents of neighborhoods will find that new people, many of them, most of them white, will move into neighborhoods and feel a sense of ownership. And that sort of culturally, socially, psychologically displaces the older residents. For example, a friend told me about an incident where one of her friends who's lived in a Capitol Hill neighborhood for over 20 years, the new residents who've moved in, one night he was out walking his dog, and someone called the police and reported that a strange black man was walking his dog in their neighborhood. Now, why I would go to a different neighborhood than one I lived in to walk my dog, I'm not sure.
Right.
Okay, so that's one thing. Well, the police actually came actually came, and this is the new D.C., and questioned the man, made him show his ID. Now, either the people who live in that neighborhood had never fully looked in that man's face, because usually when black people live in a neighborhood, we know people, you know.
Right.
We look at them. We know who lives where, et cetera. But there's a tendency that's very disturbing for new people to move in, and the older residents are simply invisible. So this is one of the most disturbing, and this is not true in all neighborhoods, but it happens enough that it's something that people are very, very deeply concerned about. And it literally drives people, black people, out of neighborhoods because they're looking for a place where they can feel comfortable again.
Right, and if the police are called on you when you're walking your dog, which we all know people do when they're going to commit a crime, right? They take their dog out.
Exactly.
Let's switch gears a bit and talk about Migrations of the Heart. Well, tell us what those experiences like. Particularly, you married, you moved, and then you moved back to America.
Mm-hmm.
Talk
mm-hmm.
about that experience for you.
Well, it was the book's title just sort of came to me, and I think it's an apt title because one of the reasons I ended up having that experience was because my heart had literally been broken by the back-to-back deaths of both of my parents. My mother died when I was a junior at American University, and my father died 2 years later when I was about ready to graduate from the journalism school at Columbia. And so there,
and Columbia is in New York.
New York, yeah. Mm-hmm. Their back-to-back deaths really quite naturally sent me reeling and gave me a profound sense of being orphaned. These were two people, my parents, who had really lay in wait for my success, and they did not even live long enough to see me graduate from college and to begin to become the kind of empowered, independent woman that they had raised me to be. And the fact that I felt so deeply orphaned was a big factor in my decision to marry and to move with my first husband to Nigeria. I was looking for family, and who represents family more than Africans? I mean, you know, when you marry an African, you marry a whole family, a whole extended family. And in the bosom of my first husband, I found everything that I was looking for. So I moved with him to Nigeria and lived there for about 4 years. It was a great experience in many ways. I was teaching at the University of Lagos, and I was writing. I was working. At one point, I was working on developing a woman's magazine, and I was continuing to freelance write for magazines here in the States. So, and living in a black country, there's real challenges because the culture was deeply patriarchal. But as an American woman, I was exempt from some of that.
Marita, let's do this. Let's take a break, and when we come back, let's pick up right here and hear more about what those experiences were like for you.
Mm-hmm.
let's stay in Nigeria for a bit. It was a good time for you in a lot of ways. You were able to write, you were able to teach, you were newly married, you had the family that you missed so much when your parents died. How and when did that begin to turn around for you?
Well, there had been long simmering, I would say, emotional differences between my husband and I in terms of personality, perspective, and many think that you know, well, if you married a Nigerian, inevitably there would be cultural differences. Well, yeah, there were some cultural differences, but cultural differences in and of themselves are not always a bad thing. I mean, you can learn from other people's culture and vice versa. But basically, my first husband was a very kind of emotionally closed off person who would, you know, use certain techniques to punish and control. I'm not talking about physical, but just kind of emotional game playing. And there came a point in the marriage where, because I realize now looking back that I was hibernating, that the first years of the marriage, I was licking my wounds, I was hibernating, I was hiding from the world that had betrayed me and hurt me so deeply by taking my parents away from me. And then actually with the birth of my son, that was a moment of rebirth for me. And that was a moment when I felt like I wanted to stand up for myself, for my son, for my life, and that a lot of the things that I had accepted as part of the marriage and inevitable, I was no longer willing to accept. And so that's when I slowly began to almost wake up, I don't know, when I look back on that period, I almost feel like, as I say, I may have been hibernating, I was asleep, and then the birth of my son woke me up into, you know, the realization that I could not live in this type of relationship.
Can you give us an example of something that you had at one point accepted and decided no longer?
Well, one of the issues was, for example, if my husband was angry with me, he would stop talking to me. And this could go on for a day, it could go on for a week. And it was so childish, and yet it could be very, very painful. And that was a habit. And the more, the longer the marriage lasted, the more I saw that as a very deeply cruel thing to do. And I simply wasn't willing to put up with it anymore. So I think that was the kind of thing that was habitual that spoke a lot about his need to control. And, you know, there's no laying of hands, but it was almost like being physically abused because the pain was so deep.
Well, and he, in effect, rendered you invisible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So there came a time when you said, that's it, I'm done, I'm leaving. So that must have been a really easy transition, right? You just pack up and you come on home.
No, it wasn't. You know, and in the book, I write about really having to make a very tough decision to really just leave the country with my child. In fact, I left with another woman who we both left with our children. Because we weren't confident that if we stayed in Nigeria and, you know, tried to get a divorce and all of that, that we would be able to maintain custody. And ironically, the idea of living in a black country was actually very seductive to me. The idea of raising my son in a black country was very seductive. So I would really have liked to have stayed in Nigeria, you know, divorce, stay in Nigeria, you know, shared custody. Well, no, it doesn't work like that in Nigeria. So I knew that I had to leave, and I basically ended up leaving surreptitiously, kind of dramatically. And for a while, it was very difficult, a long period of estrangement between my ex-husband and I. But actually, we worked it out, and we're friends now. I mean, and my husband's family, my first husband's family, has been really so important in my son's life. Many of his relatives lived here, have lived in the United States for decades, and they have played a very important, after the estrangement was over, a very important role in my son's life, in supporting him, supporting me. So we went through a rough patch, but the nice thing was that after all of that, we managed to fashion, you know, the happiest ending I think you can imagine.
Absolutely. I'm curious, when you left America, you left a country in the midst of all that, in a lot of ways we are still in the midst of. When you got off the plane in your new homeland, what was your first impression?
Well, I had been to Nigeria before. I had gone about 2 years earlier as part of a trip, a group tour that went to Ghana and went to Nigeria. So I went before I went as a wife,
okay.
And I went specifically to basically scope out the situation to see if I could do this and to meet his family. So, but to answer your question, the first time I landed on African soil, it was a very powerful feeling of sort of knowing this place in my bones, nor in my blood. The people, yes, were different. I was not considered a returning African unless I was talking to a very intellectual, very well-read Pan-African student. But for 99% of the African people who met me, Ghanaian or Nigerian, I was an American.
Interesting. What was their view of you as an American? What were their expectations of you as an American in general and as an American woman in particular?
Well, there were many conflicting and interesting views. I mean, it was felt, for example, that if a Nigerian went to study in America, that there was a strong possibility that he would bring back an American wife. Many younger Nigerian women, of course, weren't happy about that. And sometimes mothers were not necessarily happy about that. But I was, in my own family, I was very, very graciously accepted, partially, probably not only because they were a really open, warm family, but also because I extended myself to them. I mean, I learned to speak Yoruba. I gave myself over to the experience of trying to acculturate as much as I could. So we were both the family, and we were both trying to meet each other halfway, or you know, or more than halfway. But there were many conflicting, you know, attitudes, you know, and as an American woman, there was a certain mystique, you know, a certain prestige. Oh, you know, you're an American woman. And as an American, I was treated with deference. You know, I was treated, frankly, with more respect than Nigerians treated each other. So it's a mixed bag.
Absolutely. Let's talk about your next book. Do Remember Me. Tell us about that one.
My next book was actually A Woman's Place, but And Do Remember Me,
okay,
is the story of A Woman's Place is a story of three, because many of my books are about family, about people recreating family, finding family. And Do Remember Me is the story of two women who develop a friendship as young women and work in the civil rights movement together. The civil rights movement for me is a social movement that I find kind of endlessly fascinating, in the way that, because I was born too early. I was a Black Power baby. And I always wonder, if I had been born, say, 5 years earlier, 5, 6 years earlier, would I have had the courage to do what those civil rights workers did, you know, leave school, go south, register voters, and sometimes with their families saying, if you do this, I won't support you.
Right.
If you, because this is too dangerous. If you do this, I'm going to disown you. And I'm talking about black people.
Mm-hmm.
So I just found that movement so interesting, not just for the way it changed the country, but for what it required of people. So I've used the civil rights movement as a touchstone in one or two of my books.
The Edge of Heaven, what was that about?
That's a novel that deals with the aftermath of a situation where a woman accidentally kills her young daughter. Sometimes when I'll do a book, I'm inspired by what's going on in the world. Sometimes I'm not. I just will get an idea. But The Edge of Heaven was inspired by the fact that there was a summer in Washington, D.C., where there was a rash of, well, for lack of a better word, of baby and child killings. There were five or six incidents where young children who were left in the care of adults ended up dead, ended up killed. And it struck me. I said, how does that happen? You know, what circumstances? I mean, I knew what I was reading in the paper. So allegedly you would hear what theoretically or what happened. But there's always a deeper story. And as a novelist, I'm always interested in going a bit deeper. So I wonder, you know, I started with a question. What situation would a mother be in where she would be responsible for the death of her child? And so that took me on a journey that involved me going to a women's prison, talking to therapists, and it's really the story of the mother's return. It opens on the day that she returns, and much of it is told from the perspective of her older daughter, who's telling the story.
When you approach the books, and you've written so many, you've done just almost every kind of writing there is to be done, almost. How do you do that? I mean, you said a moment ago that you came up with an idea, you were hearing things in the news, some of it was, sometimes it's a personal experience. Is there a way, is there a process that Marita Golden engages in that routinely results in a novel, in a book?
Well, I think it has nothing to do so much with actual writing as it has to do with making myself intellectually, creatively, spiritually, emotionally available to be a portal for stories. That is, there's something in my DNA where I'm just open. I'm always asking questions. I'm curious, and I'm seeking answers, and I want to be part of the discussion. I want to create something. A lot of the desire to tell a story is to bring something, for me, is to bring something beautiful into the world, so that I'm available. Like my most recent book is about a family in Washington, D.C. dealing with Alzheimer's disease. And I have no connection whatsoever to Alzheimer's disease. And so people have asked me, well, why would you write that? How did you even get inspired?
Sure.
And for a long time I would sort of give some answer, but the best answer I gave one day was that, as I just said, I'm a person who's open and available to tell and to wrestle with and try to create difficult stories. I find them challenging. I find them affirming. And so if you're open and available, the story that is yours to tell will find you.
So it sounds like there's really nothing that you can't, I'm going to put can't in quotes, write about, as long as you allow yourself to be open. Is that a fair statement? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, to be available. Doesn't mean that it's going to be easy or you won't question your ability to do it, but mostly it just means that you will stay the course no matter what.
How do you know when your story is finished?
When there's no, when your characters have gone as far as they can go in terms of the change and the transformation that the story requires.
And so that is something that's intuitive to you as you're creating your work. Is that a fair statement?
Well, yeah. I mean, as you work with it and work with it, the story has its own rhythm. It has its own rules. And you will begin to know what's needed to bring the story to resolution.
Let's talk a little bit. We're going to take a break in a minute, but I'd like to talk a bit about the actual process of having your work published and distributed. You know, nowadays, mm-hmm. somebody can sit down and publish it in 30 seconds. And if it's on the web, it's distributed. But it wasn't like that when you began to write. It was a very different process. So I'm wondering if you would share that with us, just how that all came about.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's take a break. And let's not take a break. Okay. It's a good thing we have the ability to edit. Marita, with your first book, how did you get that out into the market? Did you have an agent? Did you have an editor? How do you even go about that process?
I had been writing for a number of years for Essence Magazine. And while I was living in Nigeria, I was working on a novel. So I came home one summer to visit family and everything, and I had the novel with me. And the editor of Essence suggested that I take it to this young white woman who was starting out as an agent. And so she read the novel, and she said, oh, you know, this is interesting. This is interesting, you know, but, and, you know, and I looked back, I found an early draft of that novel one time, and, you know, darn, it was quite good. I mean, I was a good writer, even as a young writer. So the question wasn't the writer. She said, but why aren't you writing about what you're living through now? And, of course, at that time I was pretty young, and I did not see the the intrinsic, inherent power and nature of the story that my life was. That is, I was a young woman, young black woman, who come of age in the 60s, who was a Pan-Africanist, who was a feminist, who'd married into a Nigerian family where some people were polygamous, some people were monogamous, and I was living in Africa and dealing with the contradictions of that. Now, that's a great story, but I did not see it as a story. I was too close to it. I didn't see it as a story. It was my life. So I said, I couldn't imagine writing about that. And also, this was before the time hadn't come yet where a lot of women were writing memoirs. Mm-hmm. My book, Migrations, was right at the beginning of that period where women started writing about their lives, their inner lives, their experiences, and making those kinds of stories legitimate as literature. So I went back to Nigeria, and as the marriage started falling apart, then the writer in me surfaced. And you know you're a writer when you're going through a really horrible experience, but you say, this would make a good story. and you're sort of circling around over the debris of your life like what's that bird that stuff, you know, that eats the debris. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, uh-huh. And so anyway, I was so focused on this that as I was planning my escape, which it literally was an escape, I started interviewing my family in Nigeria for information that I would need for the book. Information about African customs, things. You know, I told them that I was doing an article, you know, and tell me about this, tell me about that. So I was pretty ruthless.
Let's take it back
to the States. Even though I was, you know, I was just, of course, deeply depressed, despairing, grieving because of the dissolution of the marriage and everything that had happened. I went back to that agent and told her that I now saw what she meant, and I gave her a 60-page proposal, which was basically a sample chapters of what the book would read like.
Marita, let's stop it right there and just take a break, and we'll be right back.
Okay. All right.
Created a, as you said, 60-page proposal, which might sound daunting for some folks, but you took it back. She read it, and what was her response?
Well, she liked it a lot, and she thought that I could probably get a contract. So this was in 1980. And at that time, there was a handful of, or less than a handful, of African-American editors. And one of the, probably the premier editor at that time, who went on to be the editor for a whole, I mean, God, generation of black writers, is a woman named Marie Brown. She's kind of the godmother of black agents, and she was the agent for me and a whole bunch of people. She's now she's an editor at Doubleday. Now she's a literary agent. And so Marie loved it, but it took her a year to get me a contract. Now what happened was that, and this is how a publishing company works, she loved the book, but she had to wait until the right moment to present it to the editorial board. She had to lobby among her fellow editors to get them excited about the book, so that when she presented the book at an editorial meeting, she would have support for it. So it took her a year, and I finally got the contract, and then I was with Doubleday for virtually my entire career until my most recent book, where I switched to another publisher. So the reason that you have to do, well, these days, for example, if you're a first-time novelist, you have to do the entire book so they can see that you can actually write a book. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a nonfiction book, you don't have to do the entire book. You would do a proposal, and you would give them some sample chapters. But whatever you submit, you have to show the editors that you can write. Now, another thing about the publishing industry as it was then, the traditional publishing industry as it was, you know, like the Knopfs, the HarperCollins,
yes,
that publishing world is very, very small. I mean, it's made up mostly of upper-class white people, a sprinkling of black, a very tiny, tiny, tiny sprinkling of black people. And it's a pretty homogeneous world. Many of them went to the same schools, had the same experiences, the same politics. And it was small then, and it's probably even smaller now. So now the difference today, of course, is that you have internet and you have many opportunities to independently publish, so that even if a publisher says no, you can independently publish. Now, when independent publishing first started, you know, people literally were writing books over the weekend, slapping them together, and then publishing. But in the intervening years, you have many, many, I mean, you have so much good quality writing these days that is being independently published. People will go to Lulu.com or CreateSpace because there's so much good writing that the traditional publishing industry cannot consume all that writing. It simply doesn't have the wherewithal to publish every single good book. And then they have their prejudices, their agendas, you know, their ideas about what they want to publish, and they're a business. So it's a whole different landscape. And like, I'm working at a project now, and I don't want to go into too much about it, but it's a special kind of project, and I know because of its nature, my agent, it doesn't matter that I've done 16 books, my agent may have a hard time finding a traditional publisher for that book. So I may take the route of independently publishing. So I've mentored some really good writers. I mean, really good writers who I couldn't believe why they couldn't get a contract. And they went on to independently publish, and they had success. So I think this is actually a great time. I mean, people often complain that the presence of so many writers has damaged the quality. No, I don't think it's damaged the quality of writing at all. I mean, it just means that more people are getting published, and it means that it's harder for you to get your book through. But I'd rather live in a world where more people had access to being published than fewer.
You talked about mentoring. You are a coach yourself. What does that mean? What kind of help are you able to offer?
Well, often when people are working on a manuscript, if they've gotten, say, a 150, 200 pages, and they want an evaluation of what they've written, I'll read it, evaluate what they've written. And in some cases, after I've given them the formal evaluation and all of that, can work with them on continuing to develop the manuscript. And these days, it's just so competitive to get a contract that it really does have to be virtually finished. I mean, when I got my first contract for, let's take a novel, for example, my first novel, I got the contract, and then I think I had a 3-year deadline, you know, and in those days, you know, they said 3 years, you know, but they knew that you might take a little longer, you know, you could just get your money, go right. And they knew the creative process was not always straight and fast. Well, once publishing industries in the 90s were bought by big conglomerates, that all changed. Mm-hmm. And you had to produce your book the way tires were produced or cars were produced. So you would sign a contract, and then you'd have a definite deadline. And that would be usually be a year, so that you couldn't even approach a publisher. You could approach a publisher when I was starting out with, you know, with say with a novel, you know, maybe 25, you know, 50 pages. Oh, no. Today that novel's got to be finished if you're a first-time writer. So that much of the work that an editor in the past would do, nurturing, reading, correcting, mentoring, that you have to get that on your own now.
I see.
Or you have to hire a coach, or you have to take a writing workshop, so that we have what I call now the publishing industrial complex, which is not just publishing houses, but writers' workshops, people like me who you hire to coach you, writers' retreats, contests, magazines. So this whole big complex of support and opportunities that writers have, that in the past they would get all that from their editor. But editors now have to publish so many books, they don't have time for all that.
You've been described as a literary activist. What's a literary activist?
Well, in 1990, I co-founded the Zora Neale Hurston and Richard Wright Foundation, which is now celebrating 28 years of working both nationally and internationally to honor black writers, provide workshops for black writers, and just create more opportunities for writers of color, black writers. And so when I decided that I wanted to write, that this was going to be a real thing for me, something that was going to engage a lot of my time, I really saw that there was a lot of work that needed to be done to support black writers. So because I'd been an activist in college, and as an activist, someone who is interested in creating new paradigms, new opportunities, new institutions for black people, it was kind of natural that I'd done that previously. Now I was doing it but I was doing it in the writing world.
There's another piece of activism, if you will, that you are also credited with, and that is being a color complex activist. What is that?
Well, I wrote the book Don't Play in the Sun back in 2006, an examination of colorism, the global scourge of the belief that light skin is better than dark skin, and people who are white, people who are light, are intrinsically, inherently superior and better and more valuable than people who are dark. And so I wrote the book, and I then became, you know, someone who speaks a lot wherever I can about how to address this issue, how to talk about it in an honest, authentic way, but also in a healing way.
Honest, authentic, and healing for something that is potentially dicey for a number of people. How do you accomplish that?
Well, I think first you create a space where people know they're not going to be judged for whatever they say.
Okay.
Because I remember when I was going out promoting the book, it was so interesting that many lighter-skinned people would stand up and say that they felt they had a story to tell about colorism, that many of the stories that darker-skinned people told about being marginalized and being made to feel bad because they were dark, the same thing had happened to them because they were light. And very often the spaces where I would be talking about the book almost became like church or something, where people would stand up and maybe for the first time ever really reveal how painful and difficult and challenging it had been to be a light-skinned person, a dark-skinned person, a paper bag person, in a world that is so obsessed with color and with hierarchies and placing people in a certain hierarchy because of their color. So I think the first thing is to just say, look, let's talk about this. No judgment. And people really feel empowered by that.
Your most recent book, A Wider Circumference of Love, the book about a family dealing with Alzheimer's, what kind of reception has that received?
Well, I've been very pleased. I mean, the response has been very, very gratifying, because many people had not read a novel in which this experience, as it affects African Americans, had been traumatized. And it was very satisfying to not only do the novel, but to have, as a follow-up, to do a major piece of journalism in the Washington Post Sunday magazine about the devastating impact of Alzheimer's on the black community. And for your listeners, if they go to my website, maritagolden.com, they can actually download the first chapter of The Wide Circumference of Love. And there's also the magazine article that I did for the Washington Post. So people have been very, very gratified and moved by the book.
You know, just the word Alzheimer's sends people into a fearful tizzy. So the fact that you have been able to create a story, I think in and of itself makes it a little bit easier for folks to really engage themselves in the and into the experience of what Alzheimer's is. And as you've said repeatedly, when you write a book, you're not just sitting down and throwing together a couple of thoughts over a weekend. You're doing research, you're studying, you're being very thoughtful and intentional about the information that you provide in everything that you write.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I had to become someone who had Alzheimer's so that I could write from the inside of the experience. And I'm now an Alzheimer's activist working with a great organization, Us Against Alzheimer's, which is dedicated to making sure that African-Americans, Latinos, and women are a big part of the conversation and the advocacy.
Marita Golden, I could certainly spend hours talking to you about any book that you've written, any word that you've put on paper, but time does not permit that. So I'm going to ask you to keep your calendar reasonably open so we can bring you back again. But in the meantime, would you once again let folks know about your website address?
My website is www.marita, M-A-R-I-T-A, maritagolden.com. And on my website, I have information about my workshops as well as my books.
All right. Thank you again, Marita, so much for spending time with us today and for the work that you do and for the respect with which you approach words. Thank you.
Thanks, Pam.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a mental health, medical health, or other professional. You are encouraged to listen on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from your iTunes or Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I would love to know where in the world you are as you're listening today, so do send an email to me at Pamela, that's P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Would love to hear your questions or comments about this or any Mind Talk program. Once again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.